Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, online at bcfmradio.com. This week, Tent Village is a small group of homeless people in Bristol who fought off Bristol City Council's attempts to have them banned from the city through an injunction, a bit of a David and Goliath struggle. We speak to Stuart, who lives there. And also, Alex Joseph's with us from Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting. Sounds horrific. It's going on in China, folks. We're also joined by investigative journalist Ethan Gutman. He's the author of several books on the subject. He's a Nobel Prize nominee, and his website is endorganpillaging.org. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you've got a story for us, contact People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. If you want to volunteer, contact the National Volunteering website, do-it.org, where you'll find us. And I'll repeat the contact details at the end of the show. Now I'm joined by Stuart, and Stuart is from Tent Village, a secret location not very far from Bristol City Centre. Stuart, you're living in a tent. How on earth did you come to that sort of situation? Because actually you're not the only one in Bristol at the moment, are you?
Oh, not by a long way. I'm basically, when I was trying to get myself sorted back in Bristol, and I went to St Mungo's.
So they're the sort of statutory people you go to, are they? What sort of reception do you get there when you first arrive?
Here's your bus fare, go anywhere else. They didn't want you to stay in Bristol. It's just, we'll give you the bus fare somewhere else.
Well, I suppose they're there thinking, well, maybe this person's got some connection somewhere else, maybe a floor they could sleep on, a sofa.
Yeah, but I don't, and I have family here.
Yeah.
But they won't recognise them. I went up north to have a rather serious operation, and during the recovery time, apparently that went over the time, and suddenly I have no links with Bristol, even though 20 years ago I bought a house here. I worked at the university for 10 years. My kids are here.
It must be rather irritating to be told you've got no connection with Bristol.
Oh, yes.
So anyway, how did you end up homeless in the first place? What was it? Because, I mean, there's lots of different things that bring people to suddenly have nowhere to live. Lots of different things. So what was your story?
There was a lot of things going in my life, and some of them messy, some of them weren't. I'd come down to see my kids and I decided to stay here. And then I'm getting attitudes like that from the official bodies. And it was then when I actually was diagnosed with having serious PTSD. And then you're told, no, you're out on the streets, no one can put you
up. So this post-traumatic stress disorder was from what?
Many things, but yeah, obviously time in services.
Right, so am I right in thinking you actually served out in Afghanistan and Iraq for your country?
Yes.
For how long?
Oh, I did Gulf 1 and 2, and I did a couple of tours in Afghan with a couple of side trips as well, just for a few weeks at a time or a month.
So you would have thought that, you know, that would have given you a reasonable income, possibly giving you a start with buying a house, and, you know, that you wouldn't be in a situation where you had nowhere to live, surely?
A lot of my lads, when they came back from Gulf 1, come back with serious injuries, were given compensation and was told that money couldn't be touched. And then all of a sudden, no, you can't get benefits, you can't get housing, you've got too much money, even though that money's for them to recuperate.
That sounds crazy. I mean, you're not the only ex-service personnel that's homeless. So you came to Bristol, you decided you wanted to be in the same city as your kids. That sounds quite reasonable. How did you get on finding some accommodation?
Well, it's just not happening, is it? I'm living in a tent.
So how long have you been in the tent for now?
Well, here, it's got to be over a year now.
Yeah. Now, there are tents. I mean, it has to be said that the Bristol City Council, around about a year ago, there was a whole debacle with the City Council, this is under Mayor Ferguson, saying that actually people were found, tents were found in parks and on City Council property, that those tents would be confiscated. Did that ever happen to your knowledge? Because that's what they were saying they're going to do.
They didn't threaten us with that, but they took us to court.
Okay, so how did they do that? Take you to court for what?
We had a rather nice organised settlement in a corner of a park. Locals loved us, got on well with the community, everything. They were even helping us out. But the bloke from the council didn't like it. We were probably too well organised and...
That sounds like maybe Nick Hooper, is it? He was the head of housing for the council under Ferguson.
No, it was a bloke from Parks and Recreation, okay. I think. Richard.
Yeah, but so what happened there? They took you to court. Did you actually go to court?
Yes.
Oh, right, so you turned up in court. What happened?
Well, the first time, basically, because they tried to flank us, by dropping the papers off at 5 o'clock Friday night, and we were supposed to be in court Tuesday first thing.
So shouldn't they have given you...
We still got a solicitor and we still turned up.
I bet they weren't expecting that.
No.
I don't think most people paying their council tax would like the Bristol City Council Legal Services Department to be playing those sort of dirty tricks on homeless people. They're supposed to be housing you, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So what happened in court?
Well, the injunction they was trying to give on us, put on us, would have made it illegal for me to even sit down on a park bench and fall asleep. I'd end up going to jail. If I was forced out of Bristol and I came and slept in a camper van or something, I could go to jail. They basically, it wasn't just council property, it was all open spaces in Bristol. That could be the co-op car park.
Now, this sounds to me a little bit like the case just 2 weeks ago now in Worcester, where a woman was injuncted for begging in Worcester, and basically, because she didn't have any money, she had to beg, and because the social services wouldn't give her any money, that was the only option left to her. And what happens, of course, she asks someone for 50p, she's then arrested and sent to jail for 6 months. Now, these injunctions, Stuart, are pretty pernicious, aren't they? So they're saying to you, if you do something, then you can be jailed for trying to get what you need to live.
Yeah, the judge turned around to the council and said, are you really willing to send these people to prison for trying to live?
Well, it's nice to think that the courts are still going to stand up for people like you, but you wouldn't have been able to probably do that without having a help of a solicitor.
Yeah. So we got set back for a month so we could both gather new evidence. In that time, the council sent round border agency, people like that, to harass us at 5 o'clock in the morning.
A lot of people who are homeless also have extra problems. I'm talking about drink, drug problems.
Yeah.
So how do you cope with people like that?
We have had, they tend to be the younger generation, to be honest. And we have had to ask some who've just turned up after a couple of days, if they carry on like that, they're just out. We don't need that rubbish. We're trying to get on with our lives, rebuild them, and we don't need that rubbish going on. And they're bringing back other people, and then we become a target, so...
Do you think that actually that sometimes by going into somewhere like St Mungo's, people may be worse off? I mean, I've heard some pretty awful stories about... obviously, there's quite a lot of criminal activity in these hostels.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of our old friends who've gone in and they come out 10 times worse.
Were you into St Mungo's?
And into the Sally.
Yeah.
And then we've also had people come from those hostels who just need a respite themselves because there's so much bullying and so much drugs going on. They need a break from it.
So you're saying people actually come to you at Ted Village and say, please, can we just stay with you?
Yeah.
How do you cope with all the sort of basic things like toilets and water? And I mean, I imagine you've been in the army. You've probably had a bit of a chance to know how to deal with stuff like that. But for a lot of people, it might be quite difficult.
Yeah, well, you rely a lot on public facilities.
Actually, most of the public toilets have been closing, haven't they?
Yeah, so you've got to have a decent diet. a lot of self-control and wait till the various places are open.
There are some places around the city that you can get food, aren't there, as well, that provide free food. Are there any of those that you know that you're able to use or fairly close by or whatever?
Yeah, you've got the Goose, of course.
That's the Wild Goose Cafe. Yeah, that's Stapleton Road, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And, I mean, that's open every night apart from Saturday, when it's closed completely on Saturday. And most daytime, apart from Tuesday and Sunday.
So it's possible to eat, yeah.
Yeah, and there's things like the Methodist Centre and the Salvation Army and things like that. So you'd never actually, if you keep yourself together and know the times and opening, you will not starve.
The trouble is, though, of course, for a lot of homeless people, it's very difficult for them to keep their lives together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not very easy, for example, to get and hold down a job if you're living in a tent.
Oh, we've had that situation where we've had people staying with us and they said, oh, we'll only be here for a month or so. I've got a job. All I need to do is save up a deposit and a month's rent. But then halfway through that time, whoever they're working for finds out they're homeless and they're out on the rear.
What's your take on why there are so many homeless people now in Britain?
I mean, it's been, lack of forethought on the government side. I mean, bringing in the bedroom tax when they never built one-bedroom flats. You know, there's all that kind of rubbish. So there's not enough singular flats for people on their own. And selling off council housing and things like that is just...
Well, I mean, as someone who's risked their life for their country, do you feel let down?
In some ways, yeah.
But?
But, I mean, because I meet a lot of people on the street, they are a lot worse off than I am. Some ways I have to be thankful because I can take care of myself and I do it pretty well. But especially the kids, they're in a right mess, to be honest.
Well, why is that then? Why do you think the younger generation are they being let down? I remember reading the other day that Britain has got some of the most unhappy children anywhere in the world.
Yeah, well, they're on about throwing them all out the bear pit. Where are they going to go? There's nowhere for them to go. They're going to congregate somewhere, and especially with the youth culture, that's going to involve drink and drugs.
So, I mean, is it because it's difficult for these youngsters to get jobs, or don't they want jobs?
Oh, a lot of them, yeah, definitely want jobs. But it's also about socialisation and the way they're being brought up and where. They've never had a chance, so they don't know the difference. These are people, you look at some of them, they've given up on life before they've even started a life.
Have you got any answers to this, do you think? Obviously, you've been living this for a year now, but you must sit there and think sometimes if only people would do things differently. What are your answers?
Oh, it'd have to be long and complicated, and especially with the young ones, it's not sending them to what are basically filing cabinets as the hostels are. You've got to give them something to fight for, a goal in life, so they will concentrate and get it right. You've got to start at the bottom.
It does seem that a lot of young people don't see much of a future, that there's this kind of negativity around, even sometimes in the music, you know, as well, as part of the youth culture. Well, some of it's positive, obviously, but, I mean, I've just come back from other part of the world, not New Zealand. The youngsters there, even in places like Singapore, the youngsters there, they seem to think the world is their oyster, that everything is there for them. Our youngsters in Britain don't seem to have those sorts of chances, Stuart.
No, I'd have to agree there, and... I mean, a long time ago, and especially, I'm not going to go into party politics, but we obviously know which one's the worst. But scrapping apprenticeships, what was that about? And then sending everyone to university. Not is everyone is academically minded.
No.
And then we have to bring in the Polish to do the jobs which the apprentice should have been doing. And now we're trying to get rid of them because the job market's fallen through.
Doesn't seem very well organised, does it?
No.
What about housing and homelessness? Is there anything you think might help fix that? Because that's another thing. But it's maybe, you know, because they used to sort these things out in the past. I can remember back in the 1970s, I knew a woman who was working for a local authority, and she said, oh, I finished my job because we'd housed everybody. But now the situation's on its head, isn't it? I mean, yeah. There's just... I mean, here in Bristol, it's around about 20,000 people on the waiting list needing somewhere either in overcrowded accommodation or homeless. So, anyway, what's your thoughts about if you were in charge, yeah, how would you fix it?
I mean, because I don't know what the housing stock is in Bristol to start with. But then there are many, many properties that are just empty that could do some work on them, and then they could be brought back into use.
Well, that does seem to be happening, but only to sell them off as luxury flats. So, anyway, Stuart, have you got any sort of advice for people who do then find themselves homeless, just a sort of final kind of, what do you do? Because this could happen to any of us, couldn't it?
It depends what kind of background you're from and how capable you are in the first place. Because I could give the informational advice that I would follow, and most other people wouldn't even understand it or how to survive like that. I mean, I suppose you can go to the council, but I wouldn't cross your fingers.
Don't hold your breath, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what the housing associations are like here either, so...
And how long do you think you're going to have to stay living in Tent Village before you get somewhere, proper roof over your head?
I don't see any end at the moment.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stuart, we'll stay in touch. Mm. Anytime you want to come in, one week you want to come in, and you've got any little stories to tell us about how you're getting on, you're more than welcome. And particularly well done for fighting the City Council, who, by the way, we pay for these lawyers, I'm afraid, with our council tax, for fighting the City Council and winning. Well done. I hope to see you again soon. Thanks, Stuart.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
So I'm joined in the studio by Alex Joseph. He's from Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting. That's BAFOH. Well, it's a bit of a mouthful, Alex. What is forced organ harvesting? It sounds nasty.
Yeah, it's a pretty serious situation. And what we're particularly targeting on is a situation taking place in China where prisoners of conscience are not alone just being persecuted and tortured quite severely, but their organs are being extracted from them while they're still alive and then being sold on the black market.
Well, hang on, which organs are we talking about? Because I can imagine you may take someone's kidney and they can live, but there are other organs which are rather more vital.
Well, they have quite a vast catalogue of what organs they are willing to take, but it does, you know, everything from cornea to heart to liver to lung. So it's they don't really value life in that way, whether the body is going to survive or not.
I mean, is this sanctioned by the Chinese government?
This is part of their system, so to call it. This is part of the way they go about business, part of the way they go about handling their own citizens.
Why do they do it?
In short, they don't value human life. The mentality of the Chinese Communist Party is very different to not just people in the West, but, you know, many people around the world, many governments around the world. They have quite a long history. If you consider how long the Communist Party has been in power and how many people have lost lives to their rule, it is, you know, it exceeds more than the Second World War. So what we're talking about is very high numbers of very different campaigns of persecution, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and now what we have now is the persecution of Falun Gong and the kind of organ harvesting situation.
Now, I mean, when I was at school, I was taught that that the Russian and the Chinese communists were atheists. I mean, does this play a part, the fact that they're actually very much against people of faith and they don't believe in any kind of creator or God or anything like that? And they see it as actually an enemy of the state somehow.
Yeah, in some part it does, because obviously, you know, the way one values oneself and the way they value nature, if there isn't some sort of, let's say, you know, some righteous grounding of some sort, it is going to mean that when it comes to understanding other people's spiritual beliefs and allowing people to be free within their beliefs, they're going to be very authoritarian with it.
Sounds scary. And also, we're joined on the line by Ethan Gutman from London. He's an investigative journalist who's been looking into this organ harvesting and also being nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine. Tell us what you found out about this organ harvesting. It almost sounds impossible to be true. Surely our mainstream media in London would have made sure that the British people and other people around Europe and the United States knew all about this. Sounds like a horrific scandal. What evidence have you dug out for it?
Well, quite a bit. I mean, actually, the media has been reporting on this, but it's been less than a year. The investigation, though, started a decade ago, really in 2006. But in 2016, and actually maybe more for the British media, I'd have to say it's really been just this year. That is, The Guardian, Independent, and Times of London actually reported on it last year.
Well, that's good to hear there's been some reporting. I mean, I hadn't seen any, although, I read quite a lot of newspapers, et cetera.
I'm not saying it's always given a huge headline. Part of that is because the papers ignored this for so long that it's been kind of embarrassing. I mean, the New York Times just started writing about that this last summer. And for the New York Times, they've been well aware of this issue, but they were in a very difficult position, because what do you do when you've been sort of treating something like it's just an unfounded rumor, and then you kind of say, well, actually, there seems to be something to it. How do you do that? How do you ease into that position?
Well, it's embarrassing for them, isn't it, to admit that they've been poo-pooing a subject which is so serious. I mean, what we seem to see so much of about China is how important a trading partner China is, with the visit of President Xi to London recently, and also the funding for the Hinkley Point power station very near to us here in Bristol is all being done by the Chinese government too. So we're mostly fed information which is about how important having good relations with China is.
And they may well be right on that. I mean, to a certain extent, I'm not commenting on the value of Chinese investments or the balance of trade or something like that. That is simply not my issue. People have a right to have differences of opinion over that issue. But I'm here to say that what looked like a kidney in the bathtub story, it looked like that to me too in the beginning, is not. It's actually a huge state-sponsored program.
So you say huge. How big have you discovered this to be?
We have discovered that it's worse, we believe, based on our study we just came out with last summer, that it's 60,000 to 100,000 transplants per year. That's what China's doing. Now, China claims, or Beijing has been claiming, that it's 10,000 transplants per year. They claim that, they say 11,000 one year, they say 9,000 another year, but it always averages right around 10,000. And they've been saying that for a decade.
But so what proportion of those will be voluntary and what proportion won't? I think that's the main objection.
According to the Chinese government, 3,500 people voluntarily donated their bodies last year. And if you believed the 10,000 number that they've been claiming, that could make sense, because you could possibly get three organs out of each person, even though that's a bit of a stretch. It's a major stretch to even come up with it there. But those are made up, the 3,500 are made up numbers. We had an investigative team calling their voluntary donation centers that they set up in the major cities of China. And they literally did not answer the phone in most of them at all. And some of them, they did answer the phone after a month and a half, calling every day, different times. The researcher was instructed to say, hey, I'd like to volunteer my organs. How many donations have you gotten? And they'd say, five or three. And in some cases, they said, none, you'd be our first. These are cities with millions and millions of people. I mean, 5 million people, and they've got five donations. But there's something really wrong with that picture. And even if you accept their official numbers, we can come up with two or three hospitals, which will get you to 10,000 transplants per year immediately.
So, I mean, have you come up with evidence that...
That account for 700 other hospitals, which we've identified as doing transplants.
I mean, it does sound like, you know, the figures aren't worth the paper they're written on, but have you actually got hard evidence that people have been strong-armed into having to give up their organs and maybe even died as a result?
Well, that's my second book was called The Slaughter, and it was about that. It was really going through refugees who had come out of China. These are refugees I've interviewed usually for about 12 hours. So I'm really not terribly interested in what people say usually in the first couple of hours because it's a lot of rhetoric and they have to get a lot of things out of their system and they've been traumatized. But over time, and I've never let them know that I was interested in their medical examinations. I'd wait for them to bring it up. I wouldn't show any particularly strong interest when they did. Sometimes I'd noted and then returned to it. But the point was they were all, the striking thing was how many of them were given what I call organs-only examinations. That is, they would look at, for example, the corneas. They'd shine a light into their eyes, look very closely for about 5 minutes, just looking at the corneas, but there was no corresponding test of vision. Okay, so there's no peripheral vision test. There's no focus test. There's no reading test. Nothing, because you're not interested in the brain function here.
Okay, so can you just briefly explain for people that don't know, what is a cornea?
A cornea is what you see out of. Essentially, it's essentially the lens in your eye. And it can be removed and given to somebody else. It is a piece of tissue. And if they're not worth that much, they're worth about 10,000 pounds each, something like that. Not worth that much. I mean, the liver, the kidney, the heart, these are worth big money, right? So we're talking about, you know, 50,000 pounds for a kidney, 60,000, 70,000 for a liver, right? A heart can go as high as 80,000, 90,000 pounds.
Now, I mean, if you know, in a badly regulated country or a non-regulated country, you can see why there might be some quite massive incentive for unscrupulous doctors to monetize these organs. So, have we got evidence for that going on?
Well, we do, but there's no question about that. That's been on in the ether for a long time. We've known since 2005 that they were selling organs all across hospitals in China to foreigners, and sites were done in English, advertising the prices and so forth. There's just no question about that whatsoever. In fact, there was Tianjin Central Hospital was advertising its services in English on the web until 2014. It used to be my favorite party trick with the university audience was just to ask people to Google it, and then up would come this big, splashy advertisement for getting your lung or your heart done at Tianjin Central Hospital. But the issue is not that they're unregulated. They are regulated. This is an attempt. It's peculiar and it's Chinese. There's one part of it that's unfettered capitalism, and there's another part of it that is Stalinism. I mean, it's simply this or Marxism. It's this belief that you wipe out your political enemies. You don't argue with them. You eliminate them. And once you have a crime that the regime is responsible for, what you have to do is eliminate anybody who's been involved in that crime. Okay? And that means you try to get all the Falun Gong who know something about this. Now, it's not just Falun Gong. It's also Uyghurs, the Muslims of Northwest China, and it's the Tibetans. and some house Christians. In fact, we're starting to pick up just recently new immigrants who come out, and we're clearly given exactly the same sorts of organs-only examinations that I've described.
So, I mean, have you got evidence that, that people of faith are being specifically targeted for their organs?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what is described. For example, a Falun Gong practitioner describes only Falun Gong and has Christians being given this particular exam repeatedly, and then people disappearing and so forth. Some of the people were from a house Christian group. Some were from Falun Gong. It was a woman's camp, and they just simply one day, sort of half of them are gone. Now, we don't know. I mean, the ones I've, obviously I didn't interview of somebody who'd been harvested. I'd interviewed people who were on the verge of being harvested, finally signed a statement saying they wouldn't practice Falun Gong, that kind of thing, and were able to get out of it. But they were told, in many cases quite explicitly, this is what's going to happen. There are military doctors here. Do you understand? Right? Please tell me you understand. I can't bear to see the life of a human being being taken away just like this. I mean, that would happen. The guards would get to like, they don't just torture. They sometimes get to like the people they're torturing, right? So you have some kind of, some rather amazing incidents of that nature. The other thing is it became quite popular in these camps to, the guards would tell them, you know, if you don't behave, we're going to take your organs. And we don't do that to the regular prisoners, we're going to do it to you.
What about organ tourism, though? Because that does, I mean, you were saying that this website doesn't exist anymore in English from the hospital, but I understand that this organ tourism is still going on. What evidence do you have for that?
Well, that's fairly simple, is that you do have a vast amount of people going. It's mainly you do have many organ tourists going. It happens that about 9/10 of the trade, as we understand it, is now domestic Chinese, not foreign. But of the foreigners, we know that the South Koreans per capita know more than anyone else. And in fact, recently we have some evidence of a major hospital in Korea arranging those operations. But it's simpler than that. People get very caught up in this idea of organ brokers and the rest of it. Actually, if you get on the web and you type the words, help, I need a liver, and you go to you Google it, you will very quickly, within the first 20 hits, you will find a discussion board of one kind or another. There are several of them where people advise each other about this kind of thing. And very quickly, somebody will say, hey, why don't you go to Tianjin Central Hospital? Or why don't you go to this and this, Sun Yat-sen Hospital, or et cetera, or Beijing 309 Military Hospital. And, you know, they'll take care of everything. The price is reasonable, and it's soup to nuts coverage and so forth. So the fact that there really isn't sort of this big organ broker industry going on, except maybe for some countries like Japan, where they're very sensitive about what they do in China. And we know that the Japanese do go on a large scale, and that's usually arranged.
Now, look, I mean, this organ harvesting, there's clearly a big incentive financially to do it. Is China the only country that you know of that's doing this?
It's the only one. There's only two countries that are actually using religious prisoners. That is, religious people, innocent religious people, for their organs. And those two countries are China and ISIS.
Oh, crikey.
Okay, so you can go to ISIS. Now, they do it on a very small scale, and I tell you, the hotel accommodations, from what I've heard, are not very good. and the hygiene may not be so good. But if that's your desire, you could go to ISIS. But if you want just a kidney, yes, you could go to lots of different countries where a starving farmer will sell you his kidney. Okay?
It's pretty frightening. Anyway, also, do you think you're managing to make any inroads? Whereabouts is the soft, weak underbelly of the Chinese? Where do you think that there's a possibility to actually make them stop doing this?
Well, we're seeing signs. I mean, clearly they're very rattled by what we've been putting out and by the reaction we're getting. I mean, both the U.S. Congress and the European Parliament passed resolutions last year, you know, explicitly condemning this and saying that we believe this is happening and so forth, and referencing our work. And that's worried them. And so what they've been trying to do is get credit for reforming. So they said, we stopped harvesting prisoners. They won't mention prisoners of conscience. They won't mention the main source. They just simply deny that. But they are clearly trying to do some sort of reform, but the problem is that we're not seeing that in the actual hospitals. In other words, this isn't a really exhaustive study that we just put out. It's over 700 pages. It has 2,300 footnotes, 90% of which are mainland Chinese sources. And it's very hard to get around the fact that we don't see any sign of an end to construction, of transplant centers, and so forth. So in other words, one hand is kind of trying to mollify the international community, while the other hand continues to build these monstrosities.
And Ethan, for you, what was it that made you commit yourself so fully to investigating this particular subject?
I was interested in the... I lived in China, and I'd seen the Falun Gong crackdown with my own eyes in Beijing. And it was something I really didn't understand at the time, but over time I started to get interested. And I thought the stuff that was being written was garbage. It wasn't very good.
I mean, what did you see in China then?
Well, I mean, I saw people getting thrown into vans and old ladies getting kind of beaten up and knocked over and then driven away. And I saw the propaganda that was endless, absolutely endless. I worked at Beijing TV at the time, and, you know, I saw even my coworkers sort of collapsing into tears and saying, oh, my God, this is like the Cultural Revolution. It was very upsetting. It was like being at somebody's dinner table who you didn't know very well and somebody seeing a big family fight breaking out, and you just didn't want to be there, if you understand me.
Yeah.
It was just very uncomfortable. But over time, I started doing interviews. I mean, this is the way I work. Not as interested in documents, more interested in people. And I was doing interviews with refugees, and one refugee in particular mentioned a medical examination. And I questioned her a little bit about it, and she started looking at me like, you're an idiot. Why are you asking about a medical examination? That was of no importance. I was telling you, I was tortured, right? And I kept having to drag her back to it. And that was really striking, because there was no way. She wasn't trying to spin me. But the more I dragged her back to it, the weirder her examination became. I mean, it made no sense from a medical standpoint. And I think that was the moment, you know, which I tried to kind of replicate for the reader in my book, is to the moment where a chill went out my spine. I just went, you know, this is real.
I mean, have you thought of the sort of comparison to characters like the Nazi Joseph Mengele, who were treating Jews and other so-called Untermensch in Nazi Germany in a way as almost as if they were scientific experiments on living human beings?
Well, I think there is some parallel there. I mean, the non-parallel here is that you do have the right to convert, if you like. If you're willing to give up your beliefs and discredit your beliefs and make a video discrediting your beliefs and rat on all your friends who hold those beliefs, then you can usually get out of this. Okay, it's not just like, okay, you've got Jewish blood and you're going to the gas. This is something, you know, it's more like the Spanish Inquisition. But yet, when it comes to this procedure, yes, it's done while they're alive, often with fairly light anesthesia. I mean, we have a doctor here, right here in Great Britain, who defected and did one of these operations on a living human being who had been shot in a non-lethal way, and he removed the man's liver and kidneys, and the man died. He has no idea whether that man was a political prisoner or a regular prisoner, but he admits doing this, and that was all the way back in 1995. So this is a rather gruesome operation, and it does have, you are taking the most respected members of society, the doctors, and turning them into these sorts of Mengele monsters. You know, on the other hand, I think what's different is that often the procedure seems rather sterile and only people are often involved in only one piece of it. It's kind of like an assembly line procedure. I mean, China is not a does not lack for labor. Okay, so you have some one person who's sort of preparing the patient or sedating them somehow, because if you sedate them too much, the organs won't be as fresh. I don't know how deeply you want to get into this. This is really quite ugly to talk about.
And I think the best way to finish would be to just ask you to explain how people can follow your work, I imagine, online and elsewhere.
Well, my book is for sale. I mean, I'm old-fashioned that way. I still believe people are more likely to read things they actually buy. And that's for sale on Amazon. It's called The Slaughter. It's quite a reasonable price, especially if you buy the e-edition or a used edition, which is fine with me. The other thing you can read for free, although it's a slog to read, is our new report. And that is that also references an earlier book, Bloody Harvest, which was done by David Kilgore and David Matus. It was the first study on this, and it's a very powerful work. This is called an update, and it's simply an update to those two books. And that you will find at endorganpillaging, that's one word, .org. And you can reference it there, and I encourage people to at least go into it and spend 10 minutes looking around at that report, just skimming through it, just jumping from page to page. I truly believe that if you look at it, it is like falling off a cliff. You cannot believe the volume that we're talking about, the size of this operation.
And the size of the cover-up as well, it sounds like. Anyway, Ethan Gutman...
Well, that's right, but I think we're beginning to get away from the cover-up. And I just wanted to mention one more thing.
Yep.
I'm very familiar with Bristol. I've spent some time in Bristol. I live in London. And, you know, what Bristol has been doing, I talked to your mayor about this problem just recently in person. And I really believe that you have the potential in Bristol to change history. I know that sounds really overdramatic, but it's a fact. This is Bristol's an amazingly sort of activist, it's got an activist vibe to it. And the fact is, you know, and I know that Londoners are cynical and money-oriented, okay? I love them, but that's who they are. And they're not going to do anything to upset the delicate relationship. Bristol could make history here. If Bristol were to get rid of its twin city relationship with Guangzhou, which is a notorious organ harvesting center, you could change history.
Alex Gutman, and I'll put references to your book and that website up on our show page at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And we'll stay with also talking to Alex Joseph. Alex, do you think Bristol's got a real chance, as Ethan's saying there, to change history?
Yeah, most definitely. I remember when I was younger being at College Green, at the time of the apartheid, and even from then, and every time there is global change taking place and there's a human rights issue taking place, you will find individuals in Bristol, groups of people in Bristol, willing to stand up and say, look, we're not going to accept things to get even worse than they are. And that energy is kind of radiated throughout Bristol. And for myself, when I first heard about this organ harvesting situation and kind of realizing the kind of genocidal levels that it was on, it really kind of awoke something within me, and it really helped me think, well, I will do what I can, I will do what I can, and obviously stay level-headed and rational about it, and then slowly reach more and more people. And
well, some people might question the links with Falun Gong here.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about Falun Gong. What does Falun Gong believe? Are you part of that? Is it a religion?
No, some people may say it's a religion. However, it doesn't quite fall into the category as a religion. It's an ancient spiritual practice which consists of Tai Chi-like exercises, which fall under the category of Qigong. And people who, follow the practice live by the principles of truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance. So it's a mind and body practice which enables one to elevate their moral character, at the same time make their body healthier.
Sounds to me like a sort of spiritual thing, but do you believe in God, that sort of, It seems to be one of the main things of a religion, doesn't it?
Yeah. One of the main aspects of a religion is that you have a house of worship. And we do not have a house of worship. There is no worship in that sort of sense whatsoever.
So where do you do your practices then?
Well, today I was doing practices in my front garden because it was a sunny day. It did get a little bit hot, so I was sweating while I was meditating. But yeah, that's what I did this afternoon. This morning, I was doing exercises with my wife in the living room. On Monday, we have an open exercise site for, you know, anyone curious or interested in learning the exercises. They could come to the island and do the exercises there. On a Saturday, we go to Castle Park and we meet there and do the exercises. Other than that, it's very, you know, open and flexible in that regard.
Now, the Chinese have accused Falun Gong of doing terrorist attacks, I believe. Is there any, I mean, you know, I should ask them as well, I suppose, but is there any truth to that?
Definitely not. this is, I think Ethan touched upon the use of this propaganda, and I guess the kind of, we don't get the full extent of the Chinese propaganda. We get a watered down capitalist version of that propaganda. And what actually takes place is that they are scared. They are worried that their interests are going to be found out and their practices are going to be found out. So it's very common to use this double spin. And one story which many people may have heard about is apparently a group of Falun Gong practitioners setting fire to themselves in Tiananmen Square. Now, this was well documented, and there has been many documentaries released after that, kind of proving that, A, they were not Falun Gong practitioners, and B, these people were kind of staged. You know, it was very much Hollywood-like. You know, the cameras were there very quickly. You know, policemen walking around with fire extinguishers. I don't know if it's very common for police officers to walk around with fire extinguishers, but on that day, they did, and the cameras were right there. So these kind of staged events and this kind of systemized propaganda is astonishing. If you were kind of to look at the money they put into propaganda in China, you could make some of the biggest Hollywood movies ever.
Also, the government in China has called Falun Gong a cult.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, effectively, has Falun Gong got some sort of secretive leadership?
Somewhere? No, all of the materials to practice Falun Gong oneself are available free online. You could type in falungong.org. It would take you to a website where it's got, you know, over 20 different languages to find all of the relevant information that people study and do the exercises.
And what drew you to it personally?
For me personally, I guess at the time I was living in Kingswood, and I guess I could feel that, you know, not just maturity developing, but this kind of sense of awakening. You know, I didn't really feel like I wanted to go with the flow of struggling through life and just kind of not looking after myself. So I started doing just that, started eating healthier, started becoming more curious to what is taking place around me. And eventually I kind of felt to myself, I felt like I wanted to take an interest in meditation and Qigong. And it was the scene of seeing Chinese people do the exercises outside in the group that really had this beautiful feeling where it wasn't martial arts, it wasn't violent, it wasn't a case of, it wasn't rigid. It was just people who got up, did the exercises together and enjoyed life.
I think, you know, it's funny, but if it's collective exercise, it almost reminds you of kind of not, you know. But the thing is, the whole thing is whether it's compulsory or not. Is this something that everyone has got to do? If it is, I think people should be worried. If it's a thing that people are doing because they feel like it and they're doing it completely out of their own choice, is a whole different matter. It's actually quite nice to watch.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you can imagine, I mean, I see the back in the Nazi times where you have everybody exercising exactly at the same time on a kind of football field, and everyone is looking like they're actually not necessarily even enjoying it. You know, that I find worrying. But collective exercise, a good thing, so long as it's a choice that people are doing.
Definitely.
And they're not being bamboozled or cajoled into it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, look, it's been fascinating taking us through both the organ harvesting and Bristol against forced organ harvesting with Alex Joseph and also Ethan Goodman there, the investigative journalist. Just finally, Alex, how do people get in touch with you and your group, BAFOH? BAFO here in Bristol?
Well, the main thing is we do have a website, and that website you can request to have a screening. So to help people understand a bit more about the situation, we hold screenings of a film called Hard to Believe, as well as other documentaries that we can use, but it's mainly Hard to Believe, which gives you an overview, up-to-date view of the situation of organ harvesting and the efforts people have put in to help this situation as well. Obviously, we use social media. We use Facebook mainly and Twitter. And we do have monthly meetings where we can as well. So my suggestion would be to go onto the website, you know, look at some of the videos there, some of the facts there, and request a screening, because, you know, once you sat down with a group of people or amongst yourself to actually watch this unraveling of what is taking place right now, you will probably see for yourself that it's not very hard for us to stand up and do something about it.
Okay, Alex, Joseph, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Stuart from Tent Village, Alex Joseph from Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting, and also investigative journalist Ethan Gutman, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us with your stories through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, which is just off Jamaica Street. Phone number 0117 909 6897 or email info@prsc.org.uk. The website is prsc.org.uk. Also, you can contact us via the volunteering website, the national one, that's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. Atomic video, it's a trash. The sky's on fire from that nuclear flash.
most atomic dust and the skies raining fishes, chilling fish and sizzling, going down a missionary, well, good luck to you.